Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today is an old and dear friend. We've known each other a frighteningly long time, and I am thrilled to correct a long overdue omission in the canon of Great Minds, and welcome the current CMO of Versus, which we're going to talk about, great, great player in the booming gaming space, my dear old friend, Scott Donatan. So welcome, Scott.
Thank you, Matt. You said old twice already. I'm a little worried.
Listen, you and me both. So, Scott, I'm going to start in a funny place. On your bio, one of the entries is stand-up philosopher. And I am one of a small number of people who get that joke. So I'd love for you to share where that comes from. I think it's brilliant. And let's start our conversation there.
Stand-up philosopher is how Mel Brooks describes himself in History of the World Part 1 during the Roman Empire when he's trying to collect unemployment. And Bea Arthur tells him, ultimately, she says, oh, so you're a bullshit artist. So since I was probably 12 years old, I've loved that line and used that line. And you're right, most people have no idea what it's from. Although I will say one of the last projects I worked on when I was at Hulu was History of the World Part 2. And it was such an amazing treat to be a part of that because the first film was really important in my life. And actually, in a very strange coincidence, Nick Kroll rented our lake house without knowing us, just coincidentally, to write most of History of the World Part 2. So it was actually written in the house that I'm standing in right now in New York.
Oh, that's a great story. Yeah, we'll come back and talk about Nick and Ike Barinholtz and what a great, great project that was. But we met way back when you were with Advertising Age. I think Jill Monet was the publisher then, you and Jonah and Teresa. There was a terrific team of people. It was when we started Advertising Week, which goes back 20 years now. And I remember it was not with you and I ever, but it was very contentious between Ad Age and the former CEO of the 4A's, Birch Drake. And he used to get so mad at Jill and at Ad Age. Do you remember that era?
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the interesting things, and I think this happens with trade magazines and the business-to-business space a lot, is that there were people in the industry who believed, and I would have this argument with people all the time, that our role was somehow to promote and advance the industry. And we felt like our role was to cover the industry. You know, it was always an interesting thing. I was lucky enough to be inducted into the Advertising Hall of Achievement many years ago, and I didn't want to accept it because I saw myself as a journalist covering the advertising industry, not as a member of the advertising industry. And Rance Crane, who owned Ad Age at the time, the family still owns it, you know, to convince it, told me, no, you're very much part of it as well. And it was always an interesting thing. But I think when Advertising Week first started, Ad Age really didn't like the parade of mascots.
Right.
And just got very worked up over whether that was a fair representation of the industry or kind of maybe a dumbing down of it. It was so long ago, I don't really remember, but I remember that was the piece of it that stuck in our craw, I think, more than anything else.
Yeah. And I remember there was one day when you guys every year would publish an article that, I don't know if the whole thing was about this, but it included the salaries of many of the leading industry professionals. And they put Birch's salary on the front page. And I thought he was going to implode. I never saw someone so angry. But beyond that, what I remember, Scott, of your tenure in those days was you were really early to the game. And I would say when the book is written years from now, you were first to the table on understanding the evolving dynamic between Hollywood and Madison Avenue.
Yeah, and I mean, I appreciate that. And I think Ad Age, we and me personally, you know, and I did write a book on it, ultimately, were early to it. But I think, you know, in a lot of ways, it wasn't that we created it. Sometimes people will kind of be like, oh, you're the godfather of brand and entertainment. And I'm like, it was happening. As with a lot of things as a journalist, I think what I did was connect the dots before anybody else had, because it was bubbling up in four or five or 25 places in the industry, but those places weren't connected to each other. And I think that the role of a journalist often is to connect those dots, and then it looks like we can see around corners, but really we're just realizing that, you know, especially with Ad Age, it covered such a broad swath of all everything that is pop culture, everything that is business to business, across marketing and media and entertainment and every category from automotive to food, et cetera. And what happens is, as editor of Ad Age, I felt like our job was to help our audience figure out what was next. And we had this moment where every new media technology, starting with TiVo, that were coming along, were essentially putting the end user rather than the creator and distributor of content in control. And the end user was clearly showing that they didn't like interruptive advertising. And if they had the chance to get rid of interruptive advertising, they would. And then I became obsessed as the editor of Ad Age with the idea that if interruptive advertising is going to become, after over 100 years, less effective and less efficient, what are the things that are going to replace it? And I became particularly fascinated with the idea that brands could learn from Hollywood how to tell stories as worthy of people's time as the entertainment that those brands were usually interrupting. But the funny thing about it is, when I first started writing columns about it as editor of Ad Age, they were very critical because there were a lot of things that going on that were really ham-handed and awful examples of really product placement more than true brand-funded entertainment. But as I wrote about those things that I thought were terrible, people started surfacing to say, wait a minute, there's something really cool happening over here, and there's something really cool happening over here. You should take a look at this other thing. And then we started having initiatives such as, BMW Films, and you started seeing really wonderful examples of what this could look like. And it just was something I loved and fell in love with. I'd always loved entertainment and pop culture. I later went on to become the publisher of Entertainment Weekly, among other things. And so it was this great kind of intersection of entertainment and marketing that, to me, was one of the paths forward in a world where brands should want to be welcomed into people's lives rather than avoided.
Yeah, and you literally wrote the book, Madison and Vine. And I remember there were some great conferences that you guys did when Allison was there as well, out on the West Coast. Today, all the talent agencies are playing deep in this space. We work with a number of them. I think we're closest with the folks at UTA and their group, but work with all of them, Wasserman included, some of the, more, I won't call them quite new, but it's certainly not the history of WME and CAA and what was ICM, now part of CAA and UTA. Give us your take on where we are today. You were there, when CAA got Coke as a client and sent, reverberations through Madison Avenue and the Michael Ovitz era that the ad industry was going to crater because of what CAA was doing with Coca-Cola. Of course, that was not the case, but give us your take now, Scott. You were there at the beginning on that Mount Rushmore. Talk about where we are now, give or take 30 years later.
Yeah, happily. And interestingly, the first year that the Cannes Lions created a category for branded entertainment, now just called entertainment, CAA was up for the Chipotle Back to the Start film, which I love and still watch at least once a year and show to other people who aren't aware of it. And I remember that I was on the jury that first Cannes Lions, and somebody from a traditional agency said to me, "We can't allow Chipotle Back to the Start," which was from CAA, "to win because it'll be the death of agencies." And I remember saying, I'm sorry, I don't think our job was to protect the health of agencies. Our job is to award the best work." And CAA Back to the Start did win the Grand Prix in the very first year of the entertainment category. And that's, Jay Goodman, who was then at CAA, who now has his own agency called Super Connector Studios. He's one of the people who's been doing this for as long as it's been happening. I mean, in a lot of ways, product placement and the idea of brands being involved in entertainment certainly goes back to the earliest days of radio and television. It even goes back to Renaissance painting. I don't think we have time to get into that, but and things like the Michelin Guide, which were kind of the earliest examples of branded entertainment as well, or branded content. But I think what if we look at it, is it's 20 years now since the book Madison and Vine was published. It's 20 years this year. And Jay Goodman and I still talk about this a lot. In some ways, the industry's come really far in 20 years, and in some ways, we're dealing with the exact same challenges to this segment that we always have been. And that can be a little depressing. And in particular, there's still this idea that we don't know how to prove ROI in the space. It also is very, because it's custom content by nature, it takes longer, it costs more money. It's just these things continue to brands continue to explore this space. And in some ways, in the last year, it's had another one of a periodic series of renaissances that it goes through. where it started about a year ago. Last year, Michael Sugar, the Oscar-winning producer, wrote a piece in Fast Company about this, and it sort of became a moment again where branded content and branded entertainment suddenly exploded back into everyone's minds and into the industry. And since then, we've seen some pretty big things like LVMH and Coca-Cola and others, moving either back into or more aggressively for the first time into doing this. But it remains a really difficult, challenging space. And I always said 20 years ago, and I would say it today, every branded entertainment project is just uphill all the time. And they all constantly try to go away while you're trying to get them made. And I guess that's true of maybe a lot of great works and making a movie or anything else, but it's just an incredibly challenging space. But when people get it right, it's an incredibly exciting space.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I'm a big fan of what Michael is doing. We had one of his guys, Matt Rotondo, just spoke at our event in London, and I like what he's doing. But in many ways, and I've said this to Michael, it's just putting a new package on something that's been going on for a long time.
I agree. I think, and I've said this to Michael as well. He's fantastic, and he has done a tremendous amount to put the attention back in this space, and he's had some successful wins. I think he just won a Starbucks, building Starbucks Studios with Starbucks, and he's obviously an incredibly talented storyteller. And I think he's trying to lift everyone up who's doing this, not just his own company, although he obviously wants to succeed at this as well. But he truly believes in it. And yes, in some ways, things in that Fast Company piece were some of the same things that people like Jay and I were saying 10 plus years ago. But in other ways, you can't argue with the fact that he brought attention back to it in a new way. And he's done a tremendous amount since then, including the Way, Way Up Fronts that he launched this year. To really try to promote the idea of brands and storytellers working together. And the truth is, he's able to bring the Hollywood storytelling community to this in a way that few others have been so far. Because there's still a lot of filmmakers and talent who believe that these things are somehow corrupted by being funded by brands. And the truth is, anybody who funds any creation of any entertainment has some agenda, right? And it's just a matter of knowing what it is. But it's incredible how much there's still a bit of a stigma attached to a lot of these projects.
Yeah, well said. Just to stay here for one more second, because the 20th anniversary of the book is a true landmark. Is there something you can look back, Scott, that you thought would happen that didn't? And is there something in particular that you really got right looking back 20 years ago? I know there was an awful lot you got right, but one thing in particular that rises above.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think that in a lot of ways, the technologies have really changed since the book was written. We're talking about the time, it was only 20 years ago in some ways, and yet, you had to download BMW films overnight on your computer and hope that the laptop didn't lose its connection to the internet while it was doing that, or you got them on a CD-ROM, right? So the world is technologically, in a very different place. What I'm most proud of is the underlying principle, which was that, in a world where the end user is in control of the information flow, can brands make content worthy of their time? I think that basic principle is as solid today as it was then, and is a really noble goal. Who doesn't want to make things that people want instead of things that people want to avoid, right? So I think that basic fundamental, I'll tell people when they ask me if they should read the book now, I'm like, look, it's still in print, so sure, buy a copy and maybe I'll get a royalty check. But for the most part, the technologies in the world have really changed since then, but I think the underlying principle is still completely solid. What I wish had happened more is I wish it were a more defined industry. It remains a kind of loose collection of things. And even though most awards shows in the advertising marketing space now have a branded entertainment or entertainment, jury and award. It's really hard to define the industry. Nobody can figure out the size of it, what counts, what is in it, what isn't in it, how to measure, as I mentioned earlier, its effectiveness, and even what the job titles are of people who do it in various places. So it remains this kind of amorphous blob in some ways. And yet, yeah, as much as you see huge announcements like what LVMH is doing or what Starbucks is doing or what many other brands have been doing for a long time, it's not a clearly defined segment within the industry, and that's a little depressing, given how much attention and money is and time is spent on it, that it's really still hard to figure out exactly what it is. And I still do a fair number of juries, including for the AICP Next Awards. I'm part of their entertainment jury just about every year. And every year, somebody eventually says, "Wait a minute, what's the difference between branded entertainment and advertising?" And you're like, "Oh my God, we're doing this again. Like we're 20 years in, and we still don't know how to define it, or we still don't agree necessarily on what it is." And that part's where I wish we had made more progress by this point.
Very well said. So you referenced it, but that passion for entertainment and, really early to the game on where things were and where they were going, you then leave Ad Age and go to what was at that time a very big player in the industry, Entertainment Weekly, part of the old Time Inc. family.
Yeah, it was funny too, 'cause I'd been an editor and a journalist for 17 years at that point, and I'd only been a publisher, meaning running the business side of a media operation, for about a year, because I'd moved from being editor of Ad Age to being publisher when Jill Monae retired. And then I got a call from Time Inc. and they said, "Would you want to be publisher of Entertainment Weekly?" And I said, "I'm spectacularly unqualified, but yes." And the reason I said that is that a publisher's role in consumer magazines and media was traditionally an advertising sales role, and I had very little experience or background in that. But the people who were bringing me in at Time Inc. knew that as well, and I think they brought me in to help figure out the brand. The brand had lost its way and its identity. All of these celebrity gossip magazines were coming out and doing really well at the time and getting a lot of advertising from female oriented, brands in particular, and Entertainment Weekly decided to chase that. And that's not what it was at heart. So I think they brought me in first and foremost to help define or redefine the brand, and to then make sure that everything that the brand did aligned with that mission, and also to unite print and digital, because it had been one of those things where and the print and digital teams didn't even sit on the same floors in the Time Inc. building. They didn't speak to each other. They had different mission statements. Editorial and business side didn't speak to each other. Print and digital didn't speak to each other. And it was an extremely challenging time. It was right before the 2008, economic woes. And there was a site back then called Magazine Death Watch, which was tracking which magazines might go out of business. And at the time I became publisher of Entertainment Weekly, Entertainment Weekly was listed, number one or two in Magazine Death Watch almost every week. So there were a lot of challenges, but I think what most excited me was the chance to create a clearly defined and differentiated brand through whatever platform it was delivered. And the advertising side of it was extremely challenging all the way through, but it was and still is an amazing brand. The people who loved it, the core audience of EW, was such a solid fan base, but always a difficult business.
Yeah, it wasn't the longest chapter in your, very much ongoing storied career, but it was an interesting one. And you referred to the divide, if you will, between print and digital. You had an inside view, Scott. The magazine industry seems to have done worse at navigating changes in technology than the outdoor industry, for example, which embraced digital outdoor, or radio, which really was reinvented, in the modern era now, digitally, and of course, the podcasting explosion. But the magazine business and the newspaper business, you could argue, didn't figure it out quite as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think they tried to stay for too long on this idea that at the core of what they were was a platform rather than a brand. And if you saw yourself as a magazine first, then you saw digital and anything else you did, including events or any other expression of the brand, you saw them as extensions of the magazine. And I think the difference for brands that have succeeded in doing this is that they see their core mission at the center, not a platform. And then, print might be one platform through which that mission is fulfilled, and digital might be another, and events might be another. The New York Times has certainly figured this out in many times over. But I think a lot of brands, there's still this defensiveness. I'll hear people from Condé Nast or Hearst or some of these places, and they still will be like, I think print still matters. I think there's a revival. It doesn't matter. I love print. I love magazines. I love books in print form. But it's not about that. It's about what's the best way to serve an audience and fulfill the mission you're trying to fulfill. And I told Rance Crane when I became editor of Ad Age, I don't care if Ad Age exists in print 5 or 10 or 20 years from now, pick a milestone. I just care that it's the leading brand of news and information in its space, even if that's delivered through imprinting on someone's eyeballs somehow or whatever it might be. And I think that's the, but it's hard because if your actual business model is based on selling print ad pages, for example, and your expense side, and that's what happened as well, is built around needing to be supported by that revenue stream, and new revenue streams demand a different model. We just saw the streaming space go through this as well. You've got to figure out how to be nimble and move in that direction. But for a lot of people, that was a really painful reality to come to terms with.
Yeah, no, very well said. And I think you see a lot of folks, at what's left of that industry still hanging on, and very, very tough evolution.
I still get the New Yorker and New York Magazine and Los Angeles Magazine and the Atlantic delivered in print to my home. I get the Sunday New York Times. Of course, as you said at the very beginning, I'm old, but I also open the New York Times app 20 times a day. And to me, it's not a newspaper with an app. It's a brand of news and information that I don't always agree with, but I trust across any platform it's delivered.
Yeah. So putting your editorial hat back on for a moment, one of the things that I worry about is a lot of these institutions, like the New York Times, and I think in recent years, as they've moved more heavily on a subscription model versus a pure advertising model, it's gotten better. But do you worry, Scott, with your editorial hat on or through that editorial lens, that a lot of the institutions that we've relied on the media to sort of keep everyone honest are not as strong and don't have as strong an ability to do that as their businesses have gotten weaker?
Yeah, it's definitely a concern. I don't see anything else kind of replacing it. I mean, certainly there have been some news sites that have been born only in the digital spaces, which are doing, great and are credible. But I think that the number of kind of trusted news sources, whether they've earned it or not, we certainly know that trust in the media has been declining. But I think legitimately, and look, some of this is subjective, but I feel as if you go back a few years, the Washington Post and the LA Times and others, seemed like serious contenders to the New York Times as national and international global, news sources. And I don't think that's as true today. And I think that's unfortunate.
Yeah, no, I think that's a real concern. Okay, so let's move on. We can get stuck in any number of places here. IPG has a vision. They recognize your talent, and Ensemble is born. Great, great run there as chief content officer. Did some incredible work. I remember something in particular you did with Jason Bateman and Will Arnett. That was very memorable. But talk about that run, which was really extraordinary, give or take 5 years with IPG.
Yeah, it's funny. When I left Entertainment Weekly, I got a call. I left Entertainment Weekly on a Friday, and I got a call on Monday from someone at Interpublic saying, "Oh, good. I'm glad to know that you're figuring out what's next because I wanted to offer you a job." And they actually basically said, "Listen, when you wrote your book, Madison and Vine, we weren't sure that it was a real thing. We thought it might just be, BS. But turns out every one of our clients and prospective clients is asking what our point of view and capabilities are in branded content, and we don't have any. Can you help us build that?" And I remember I said at one point, "Listen, I'm a journalist. I'm an observer of this space. I wrote the book as an observer, not a practitioner." And what I got back was a challenge, which was, "Hey, put your money where your mouth is. If you believe this is the future." This was Nick Bryan and Matt Seiler and Jackie Kelly were all involved in helping to bring me over. "If you believe this is the future of marketing, then help come help bring it about. And so I went over and started essentially a boutique agency inside of Interpublic to work with the clients, mostly of their media agencies, to figure out what branded content was and would be. And you're right. One of my first projects came through Gotham, one of the creative agencies at IPG, which said, "Hey, our Denny's client is asking us about doing something in the long form content space, and we don't really know what that means. Can you help us figure it out?" And we created this web series called Always Open with Jason Bateman and Will Arnett, hosted by Dave Koechner, with tons of celebrity guests and Amy Poehler and, just incredible Sarah Silverman, incredible list of comic talent. And it was an improv chat and chew talk show that happened to take place in a Denny's. And it was highly successful. And it became really fun to have gone from, and again, it wasn't my idea. It was, I think it was Nick Bryan's idea, that you can actually not just write about this and observe it, but do it. And I spent the next 10 years of my career doing it at both Interpublic and then Publicis with Digitas.
So talk about that evolution from, it's a very insightful thing and shows great self-awareness. You said it's very different being an observer versus being a practitioner. You did clearly navigate that evolution brilliantly, but I'd imagine there must have been some moments when you were, reflectively to yourself, like, can I really do this? Like, I've been writing about it, but that's a different ball game, putting it into action, if you will.
Oh, 100%. I'll say, the funny thing is, and I say this openly, I haven't been technically qualified for any role I've had since I was the editor of Ad Age. I was a journalist. I studied journalism in school. I was the editor of my high school newspaper. I was the editor of my college newspaper. I have a degree in journalism. I worked in journalism for 17 years, and that's what I was actually trained in and had the technical skills to do. Everything else since then, I've jumped into the deep end, not knowing if I could swim. And look, sometimes I've had, I've struggled at that, and sometimes I've wildly succeeded. But it's all been fun. I don't think I've never taken a job, maybe since my first job, that hasn't scared me in terms of whether I could do it or not. But I also think a lot of how I manage and lead, which is to surround myself with really smart, great people, to help give them, the tools that they need to do their best work, and to get out of their way to some degree. And so I think that's what's always helped me as well, is I've never had to do any of these things alone.
Yeah, no, that is the hallmark of a great leader, no question. So you do have this great 10-year agency run, give or take five at IPG and five at Digitas. You launched Digitas Studios, did some great long-form work for some iconic brands, Amex, Starz, Travelers, Lenovo, Taco Bell. That's a big task to build a studio within a shop like that and really brought that notion of connected creative to life.
Yeah, and there had been some things done by Digitas before I got there, and people who kind of helped blaze that trail a little bit in doing content. Digitas, remember, created the new fronts. I think I was able to come in and take something that had already been happening to some degree and put more shape and form to it and just elevate it to another level and then take it global. A lot of it was even just how you branded certain things, even just I kind of learned early on in my career, and I ended up even at doing this at Hulu with Greenhouse, that just naming something sometimes and giving it its own mission and clear, path of what you were trying to accomplish in the world, it goes a long way towards helping you get there. You actually have to back that up, obviously, but it is this thing that says we're planting a flag in this space and we're going to go after it aggressively. And that's what Digitas did. It's funny, I never wanted to work on the agency side of the business. I didn't get into this, but I was resistant to Interpublic when they first approached me, in part because I said, no, thanks. I don't want to work at an agency. It's still funny to me that I spent, 10 and a half years, I think, on the agency side. So when Tony Weissman at Digitas first reached out to me, I didn't even want to have breakfast with him because I said, it's okay. I'm doing fine here at Interpublic, and if and when I ever leave, I'm not going to go to another agency. So I'm just going to stay here and then maybe do something completely different. And then I met Tony in person, and I was like, oh darn, I have to go work for this guy. I love the vision he has. I love what he's trying to build, and what he's going to give me, the ability to build. within. And I was hired at the same time as a new chief creative officer, and we kind of came in together with this idea of connected creativity across every platform. And, you know, it was just ended up being the ultimate reason I really went to work for Digitas was I thought it had the data and technology chops at a level that almost nobody else did in the industry at that time, and that I could really learn and advance the craft of what I was doing by using new technologies to change the way we were, you know, creating and telling and distributing and consuming stories.
Great, great stuff. And somewhere along the line, the good people at Hulu come calling.
Yeah, I similar thing. I'd actually moved to LA while I was at Digitas for purely personal reasons, which is I wanted to live in LA and had the opportunity to do it. But Digitas didn't even have an LA office at the time. But I was flying around the world. I had a global role, and I was based in LA. And then we got a new CEO at Digitas who gave me a promotion to oversee all of the creative, including traditional brand creative, as well as experience design, production, and branded content. We rolled that all together into one global operation. But I moved back to New York to lead that. And then less than a year after I moved back to New York, Hulu called with this LA-based job. And as much as I loved the idea of going to Hulu, I was actually my first reaction was, I'm not moving cross country again. I just got back to New York. And then eventually I fell in love with the opportunity that Hulu was putting in front of me. So I picked up and moved myself back to LA again. And I joined Hulu as the chief creative officer originally to basically build an in-house creative team of 100 people, which we did quite successfully to oversee all creative for the brand, for the show launches, as well as to create a branded content unit and team within Hulu. So that was a really exciting opportunity that I ultimately jumped at.
And talk about Greenhouse, what you built there, because it's quite unique within that ecosystem, you know, a sort of digital native, very contemporary company versus building something that's really as old as the hills, as we discussed, within a traditional agency. Very different building what you built with Greenhouse inside of a company like Hulu.
Yeah, and it was really cool opportunity because I wanted to build this in-house creative operation and studio. I never called it an in-house agency because I always wanted to continue to work with outside agencies because I think if you don't challenge yourself with outside thinking, you can become a navel gazer really quickly, you know, and get caught up in your own, you know, belly button lint and forget to look around the world. So we created something that was able to really we brought in some great creatives from great agencies. And we had a team that could do almost anything. They could create long form content. They could create, you know, 30-second spots. They could create social, you know, activations that were mind-blowing, experiential. And so we just built this amazing team, but we also built it to always continually work with outside agencies and partners to fill in gaps in our expertise, or just, as I said, bring in outside thinking and a fresh perspective and have somebody call bullshit on us if we needed that, if we were too close to, you know, what we were doing. But overall, the work was just to elevate the Hulu brand, elevate the work, take the great shows that we were launching and make sure that they found the audiences that they deserved. And, you know, it was really fun and exciting because you were not just reflecting pop culture, but making it.
Great, great run, and some big success, as I recall, with one of my favorite shows, Only Murders in the Building.
Yeah, it was great. So about a year after I got to Hulu, I became the chief marketing officer, which again, another turn in my career that I wasn't expecting or even looking for, that came and found me and terrified me a little bit. But I'm really glad I went on to spend the next 2.5 years at Hulu as the CMO, but always stayed very close to the creative things. And one of the first things I wanted to do from when I got to Hulu was to start to do some after shows and you know, spin-off related series to our shows as a form of marketing, something that obviously other parts of the industry had done but hadn't really been done in streaming because it wasn't linear and people felt, you know, I'm not going to necessarily watch something after something else if it's not a linear experience. And so we created our first after show for Handmaid's Tale, and then we created one, it was called One Burning Question, and then we created one for Rami called One Cup of Tea. And then we created one for Only Murders in the Building called One Killer Question. And One Killer Question ended up being Emmy nominated, and it won the PGA award last year for short form content. So, it was kind of funny that a lot of people just assumed that that was the programming team at Hulu, and we couldn't have done it without their help and support. But it was the marketing team that really drove that, and really gratifying to end up with a PGA winning, Emmy nominated series as a result.
What a well-deserved recognition. Great stuff, Scott. So I think I mischaracterized versus your current gig. It's so much more. It was something I had seen about the gaming space, but this is a whole colossus that you're building there around really leading-edge media and technology. Talk about versus how you got there. It's a startup. It's a little bit different for you. Some very big players involved behind it, including yourself, of course. But give us the versus story and take us up to the present day.
So after I left Hulu in July of last year, 2023, I started doing some consulting and advisory work, and I joined the board of NPR, and I was kind of enjoying all of these things. And I had met this company Versus while I was at Hulu. One of its investors, Jeffrey Katzenberg, called up and asked if we would take a meeting. And we took a meeting with the CEO, and we started the path of what it would look like to partner with Versus. And then after I left Hulu, the CEO and founder, a guy named John Vitti, called me up and wanted to hire me and to help build a marketing operation. And I said, "Well, I'm doing consulting work now, and why don't you come on as one of my clients and help you build a marketing function and hire some talent?" And he said, "Okay," somewhat reluctantly from the beginning because he wanted me to, go work for him full time. And I took on Versus as a consulting client, and then just about a month into it, John was like, "Listen, I really want you to join this thing full time," and made me an offer to come and be a part of what he was creating. And I'd really come to believe in it at that point. And what Versus is like a lot of great companies, it's based first and foremost on a natural existing human behavior as opposed to creating an existing human behavior. And that is that when you're a fan of something, whether it's a sports team or a TV show or a movie or a franchise or a character, you have thoughts and opinions about that that you want to share and express, and scratch the itch of, if you ever watch a TV show with someone, I know I have it in my house all the time, and they go, "I think this person, I think the butler did it. I think this person's gonna, break a record tonight. I think that whatever it might be." That's a natural human instinct. And so John had created this idea of, when we have those instincts and we're watching TV or we're reading an article on a site or interacting with content on any platform, right now we have to leave the ecosystem where we're consuming that content. And we go express those thoughts and opinions as fans on Reddit, on X, by text to the person or, by talking to the person next to you. And essentially came up with this idea that if you could gamify content in real time, in the ecosystem where it's being consumed, you would basically drive engagement for these media companies by having people spend more time in their ecosystem and come back more often. So we're a B2B2C company. The consumer part of it is that we are serving those fans and making the experience of fandom more fun, interactive, and rewarding. And for our partners in media, which include Forbes, Disney, the NFL, Microsoft, so many great partners, we're gamifying the content on their platforms and getting people to spend more time with them. And if you're a media company today, acquisition of new audiences for most media companies is becoming more expensive and less efficient. And so engagement is the game and loyalty is the game, especially in the streaming space. It's all about, sure, you're building new audiences, but ultimately you have to keep those audiences, keep them engaged, give them a reason to spend more time with you. And what we found is our technology is content aware, as we say, which means we literally, if you're reading an article on usatoday.com or you're watching a streaming show, and we can, our technology is aware of the content that you're consuming and can immediately create a summary about it and a game based on it. And that allows people to play that game right in the environment where they're consuming the content. They spend more time with you. They can win rewards for being right. And so they come back more often. And it just becomes an incredible engagement engine for our partners in media and entertainment.
And how's it going so far?
It's going great. I mean, this is a company that is backed by people like Eric Schmidt's Steel Perlow is on our board. As I mentioned, Jeffrey Katzenberg is an investor, Reid Hoffman, Mark Burnett, Kevin Mayer. You know, it's a company that's attracted some incredible investors and advisors across the entertainment and technology spaces who really believe in what we're doing, and a great group of partners, as I mentioned, and many more coming on board soon. So it's really great. And I think what's great about it is it is based again in just kind of a fundamental serving of audiences. Who doesn't want their audience to be fans? And you know, what better way to create fans than to let people express their fandom, to predict what's going to happen, predict the outcome of an event or a game or something happening in pop culture, express their opinion on it. You know, is Beyonce or Taylor Swift going to top the charts? Will the greens or the blacks take the Iron Throne? All of these things that are in culture that we all love to debate and discuss and share, we allow that to happen within, you know, any entertainment or media company's ecosystem. And it's a pretty cool thing. I will say the number of calls we're on where the first time people are exposed to it, the usually the first thing out of their mouth is, this is a no-brainer for us. So it's really great. As you mentioned, I haven't really done startup prior to this, and it's really wonderful to be a part of building something from the ground up.
It's a great story. And Scott, it's been an absolute joy to know you over the years. We've been lucky enough to have you on stage with us many times. I remember you did a great job for us, got to be at least a dozen years ago, interviewing Kris Jenner on stage, went back when we were in Times Square. I think that was at the Hard Rock. We look forward to having you back in the fall. Let's follow up on that and make sure we get something done with you. But a tremendous story, and you got an awful lot to be proud of, my friend.
Thank you, Matt. This has been such fun. Thank you for giving me the time and the opportunity to share some of these stories and thoughts of my own.
All right, we'll talk soon, buddy.
Take care, Matt. Bye.